Please rise.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Ross, Judge Connolly, the Honorable Sarah I. Wheelock presiding.
Good morning. You can sit. Well, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's Wednesday, June 18th, 2025, and we have three cases on our calendar today, two of which are scheduled for oral argument. Let's see. We have Judge Connolly and Judge Ross here today, and we're also holding our arguments here in Courtroom 200. These arguments are recorded by the court. We'll make an audio recording that'll be available on the court's website within about 24 hours. So please remember to speak clearly and introduce yourself and the name of your client when you begin. And with that, Marshall, please call the first case.
The first case this morning is A24-1981, Renee Hogendorf versus James G. Green, Jr. et al.
Yes. So, counsel, you probably both know that you'll each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. And counsel for an appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There's a timer that appears on the center podium. The center podium does move up and down, so feel free to adjust that for you. And let's see, counsel for appellant, we can begin when you're ready.
Good morning. Cara Passaro, counsel for the appellants, Well-Groomed Lawns, and James Green, Jr., and may it please the court. So appellants in this case have presented seven different issues on appeal, and clearly I'm not going to be able to cover all seven in the time allotted. So I'd like to focus our time on construing the language in the Minnesota Environmental Response and Liability Act, MERLA. There is very little precedential case law assisting us in construing the language in the statute. And as a result, I think we're going to need to make some case law today. Some of the arguments that I have advanced are novel, rhetorical, common sense arguments, but somebody had to do it for the first time. So I would like to discuss the definition of a release, what constitutes removal costs that are available to a prevailing party under the statute. What constitutes actual economic loss under the statute, and who constitutes a responsible person. So first, I would like to consider, have the court consider the timing of the institution of the action, the underlying action, the MERLA claim. Insofar as, the facts, the basic facts are that Well-Groomed Lawns runs a landscaping company out of a pole barn on a residential property in Andover, Minnesota, which is owned by James Green, Jr. And in the spring of 2021, Mr. Green directed the staff of Well-Groomed Lawns to install a PVC pipe to run from the floor drain in the pole barn, and they did so. And unfortunately for all involved, Mr. Green was unaware of the fact that the staff daylighted that PVC pipe on the Hogendorf property, the adjoining property. And Ms. Hogendorf ultimately discovers that PVC pipe and then starts an investigation. She retains Landmark Environmental.
Is it safe to say that previous to the what you describe as daylighting the pipe, that there was a different pipe that was being used for about 20 years? And that there was discharge going through that pipe for all of that time?
Yeah, prior to the installation of this particular PVC pipe, there had been an alternate place beside that pole barn where the staff would put the rinsate and other materials, other residues resulting from the landscaping operations that they were conducting. So Ms. Hogendorf retains Landmark Environmental to conduct some soil testing. They ultimately perform that testing. She then ultimately gets that testing to the MPCA, who issues a notice of violation to Well-Groomed Lawns, the regulated party, in November of 2021. So Ms. Hogendorf asserts the Merla claim.
I think we should just jump right into the statutory arguments that you want to make today, and given, as you pointed out, the number of issues and the amount of time that you have. Could you explain to me why it would be reasonable for us to look to the pesticide chapter to import definitions in our interpretation of Merla?
Yes. The pesticide chapter really controls all of the compounds that were that are at issue here that were released. And the term pesticide under the statute actually encompasses fungicides and herbicides as well. They're all considered pests. And as a result, it's important to look at the definition of pesticide and look in particular at what the parties have been referring to as the agricultural exemption under Merla. For any releases of...
But, I mean, your client's not a farmer, right?
Correct.
So, based on that fact alone, why don't you lose?
Well, the types of products that they're using as part of their landscaping operation are the agricultural products that are controlled by the MDA. And in fact, the MDA was involved in the investigation and remediation process here, precisely because they're the same kind of herbicides that are used in a commercial farming setting.
But is it fair to say the difference would be that farmers sort of put this on their property to, you know kill the insects or whoever's ruining their crops, whereas you're just washing it off your trucks, right? I mean, is that...
washing of trucks.
Yeah.
And there is washing of equipment. There is dumping of rinsate onto the turf.
Okay.
Which is the correct disposal method for products like that. So we have all of those activities happening that are contributing ultimately to what was found on Ms. Hogendorf's property. And so the argument is that there was no qualifying release under Merla where all of the compounds at issue fall under the agricultural exception insofar as they were all pesticides. So that is the argument that's being advanced. There's some back and forth here about the definition of residue and the statute refers to residue. Appellant's contention is that residue is the broader term. It encompasses any pesticides that would have ultimately made their way down the drain. The Black's Law Dictionary definition of it supports that reading. And also the fact that the agricultural exception in Merla doesn't specifically mention rinsate really it is a testament to the fact that it wouldn't be necessary to mention rinsate because rinsate essentially is residue. So it would be redundant to call that out.
It's not clear to me that it is redundant. I think it may be that we're dealing with very specific terms in some of these legislative actions that have to do with the environment, and that rinsate, in fact, is distinct from residue. Why is that not true?
Why is rinsate not? Rinsate essentially is the residue of the pesticide within the container. You create rinsate by taking residue and adding water to it and swirling it around the container and then disposing of it. So, rinsate is just a term of art that's used in the agricultural industry. So, one of the arguments that appellants were making as it relates to the timing of the Merla claim was whether or not it makes any sense for Ms. Hogendorf to be able to bring the claim 6 months after the state agencies had already issued the notice of violation and started spearheading the investigation and the ultimate cleanup. I think that Merla ostensibly acts as an environmental whistleblower type statute, and it functions in a similar way to other sort of private attorney general statutes where, the private citizen who brings them is rewarded with, the attorney's fees and other costs because of the good to the public that's being served. Here, we've made the argument that bringing a MRLA claim 6 months after the notice of violation was basically superfluous, was not reasonable and necessary, and we question whether or not such a claim can even be brought in such an attenuated manner months after the problem has been pinpointed and the investigation has been commenced by the state agencies. Another argument that is being advanced by the appellants is whether or not the removal costs that ultimately were rewarded or awarded by the trial court are appropriate in this instance. The only sort of case law guidance that we have about removal costs being awarded under MRLA to a private citizen bringing a claim is the Kennedy Building Associates case. And in that instance, we had a very similar situation where a private citizen hired their own environmental engineers to do some investigation, and ultimately the court refused to award those costs as not being reasonable and necessary under MRLA. Of course, Ms. Hogendorf, it was always her prerogative to have her own engineering firm, but there's no good reason for my clients to have to pay for it because...
Well, it seems that the district court found that, in fact, there was a great reason for that, which was that each of those companies was dedicated to its own client, and by having the companies involved, both of them, I think the language was that they reached a more prudent, just, and reasonable result. So why isn't that? Why can't we defer to the court's determination there?
Well, I mean, I would agree that perhaps Landmark's participation was helpful and that there was a better result ultimately given their participation, but better and helpful is not necessary under the statute.
I guess I interpreted that language to mean it was necessary to reach a just result because the other company, Pinnacle, I think it was beholden to your client.
Well, yes. Pinnacle definitely was being funded by my client, and coming up with a remediation plan and delineating the problem and answering to ultimately to the state agencies who ended up approving that plan, and that plan ended up getting implemented, and the remediation ultimately was performed and paid for by my clients. So another item of damage that was awarded by the trial court here was diminution of value, stigma damages, basically, in the $235,000 range. And it seems that a component of that diminished value award were some future engineering fees that really don't make any sense insofar as there hasn't been a showing of any need of future in engineering by any potential buyer. The statute talks about the ability to cover actual economic loss, which in my mind means something that's actually been incurred. Here, stigma damages seem to be the kind of speculative and conjectural type of damages that should not be available under a statute like MRLA. Clearly here, with no intention to sell the property at any point in time in the future, it's not the type of, there's no injury, there's no damage to the property that's being compensated by that damage award. Now, diminished value damage, are those available for claims in tort? Absolutely. For eminent domain? Absolutely. But, we have to, given the rules of statutory construction, we have to assume that the inclusion of the word actual in the statute was intentional. So
why would those damages be allowed in tort as non-speculative and treated as speculative here? Because same speculative damages are not permitted even in tort.
Right. I would say, as defense counsel, that they're speculative either way. But there certainly have been instances that the respondent points to in the briefing of them being available as an item of damage. when properly supported by expert opinions with the proper foundation. But we basically contend that they're not an item of damage that should be available under MRLA insofar as they're not actual
economic. Isn't diminution of value one of the most common ways of evaluating economic harm when we're talking about real property?
Yes, it is a common way to be able to evaluate economic harm.
So why wouldn't we look to that here?
Because of the inclusion of the word actual, because this is not damage that's actually been incurred by the homeowner, by the property. I mean, my answer would be different if she could point to actual economic loss resulting from a buyer saying, I am not willing to pay full market value for this property in light of the fact that there had been past contamination. I think it's also significant to note.
What's the strongest legal support for the proposition that diminution damages are not actual damages?
You know, there's no definition in the statute for actual. The only thing that I could really come up with to provide some sort of guidance as to how we should define actual economic loss is in connection with in a criminal restitution type setting where that terminology has been used and I think would be instructive for us here if we're searching for, you know, some sort of meaning or import to the word actual. Restitution is not available unless, you know, there is a demonstrated actual economic loss, and I think that that sort of rationale should apply here as well.
Well, is there authority to support, even in the criminal arena, to support the notion that harm to the value of property is not actual loss?
I can't come up with any. I was unable to find any. Again, it's a novel argument being made for the first time. I'm asking this court to basically tell us.
But if we're to borrow from the criminal law, I would suspect you'd point us to something in criminal case law that would say it's excluded. This type of damage is excluded, but I'm gathering you haven't found anything even in the criminal case law to support your theory.
In our briefing, and forgive me, Your Honor, I don't have the cite off the top of my head. We did find a criminal case involving restitution where there is some discussion of what actual economic loss means. I know
Counsel,
that I'm out
your
of time.
Time is up. Did you have another question
no,
to address? When you come back, I want to revisit the discussion about residue release and rinsate. My thought is that it's unclear to me when you say the rinsate is just a mixture of water and pesticide, how that would not be covered by MRLA, given what we know about MRLA, why it was passed, what it says. The objectives that it was attempting to achieve, because it seems that any amount of water, you could mix any amount of water with that, and the same amount of pesticides would be released into the environment. So when we come back to rebuttal, if you could be prepared to address that, that'd be helpful.
Sure.
Okay. We will next turn to counsel for the respondent. Feel free to adjust the podium as needed. The timer has been reset, and you can begin when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Will Florek, and I represent respondent Renee Hogendorf in this case. This case is not as complex as appellants would lead you to believe. It's a straightforward application of MRLA's plain language to clear undisputed facts. There's no dispute that appellants own a landscaping business next door, that they installed a pipe onto Ms. Hogendorf's property, that they discharged pesticide rinsate and other chemicals down that drain and contaminated her property. While appellants raise several issues on appeal, the fundamental issue before this court is whether the trial court correctly applied MRLA's plain language to these undisputed facts. Specifically, is pesticide rinsate included within the agricultural exemption? Is Mr. Green a responsible person under MRLA? And did the trial court correctly award removal costs and damages for actual economic loss to Ms. Hogendorf? I'll briefly go through each of these issues. To start, under the agricultural exemption, it is clear based on the plain language of the statute that pesticide rinse was not meant to be included within the exemption. Under Minnesota Statute 115B02, Subdivision 15, which is referred to as agricultural exemption, it makes reference to certain qualifying language that exempts certain activities from a release of a hazardous substance. This includes the disposal of pesticide containers and pesticide residue. The exemption also makes a specific reference to 18B01, Subdivision 18, for the definition of a pesticide. In that exact same statutory section, under Subdivision 25, pesticide rinsate is also defined. By making specific reference to this exact same statutory section where pesticide rinsate is defined, yet not including that within the language of the exemption, the legislature's intent here is clear. They did not intend to include rinsate within the exemption. Under appellant's broad interpretation of this agricultural exemption, it would essentially render meaningless the qualifying language, disposal pesticide containers and disposal pesticide residue. It would also render a quite absurd application to this case. Appellants would be allowed to violate Minnesota pesticide law yet escape liability under MRLA, which was a statute fashioned by the legislature to hold those accountable, strictly liable for the release of a hazardous substance. This is obviously not what the legislature intended. Accordingly, we'd postulate that the trial court correctly held that this rinsate is not included within the exemption, and we'd request that this court affirm that ruling. In regard to the issue about responsible person, it's also clear based on the straight...
I was wondering, Mr. Florek, if you could skip to economic loss.
Why
is diminution of value included in economic loss under the statute? Why do you think that's the case?
Yes, so as Judge Wheelock kind of hinted at, the language of actual economic loss in part defines that as injury to destruction of or loss of real property. The only real way to measure injury to real property is to look at the diminution in property value. And as the court has already recognized, this has been observed by Minnesota courts in several contexts, from tort law to eminent domain proceedings. Additionally, this measure of damage, diminution property value, is generally measured by the before and after rule, which looks at the property value before the contamination and then after the contamination, which is exactly what the trial court did here. So based on the plain language of the statute, the only real reading of the language injury to real property would be to measure those damages based on diminution in property value.
The argument is that diminution in value is generally speculative. It's not an actual damage. And specifically in this case, the argument, I believe, is that there wasn't enough evidence to move it beyond speculation. So I think you've addressed the first part of that. Can you address the second?
Regarding the evidence, having enough evidence?
Yes, in this case, to move it from speculative to actual.
Yeah, so I would refer to the court to both Dealers Manufacturing by the Minnesota Supreme Court and Westling. Under both of those cases, I believe under Westling, Peter Patchen, who was the appraiser, the expert appraiser in that case, did exactly what Hosh Appraisal and the trial court did here. So they looked at the cost of cleanup as well as what opposing counsel is referring to as stigma. Mr. Barclay, our expert appraiser, refers to it as environmental incentive and environmental risk. But Peter Patchen, who both of these experts in this case refer to as an authority, he found that the cleanup costs and the stigma value associated with the property can render that property's value at essentially zero. He did this using the before and after rule that I just talked about, which is exactly what Hosh Appraisal and the trial court did here. So there is authority for finding that this way of calculating diminution in property value is not speculative. Additionally, I would just point to the Hosh Appraisal directly. They analyzed both five different comparable sales in the area as well as two contaminated properties in addition to all the other methods they did to look at how contamination would impact a property. This includes market interviews, literature review, looking at the neighborhood analysis, an industrial premium, et cetera. And so they took all these factors into account in calculating this diminution in property value. And I would just then refer back to the trial court's ruling that Mr. Barclay, in addition to having sufficient foundation and being found credibly reliable in his appraisal, was also found to credibly testify about the recent developments in the case and considering those when looking at how that impacted his initial appraisal. So I think all that evidence shows that there was sufficient reliability and foundation here, and that it was not a speculative award for actual economic loss in this case.
Since I'm not sure there's any Minnesota case law that allows this type of damages under Merler, would you also be in favor of a presidential opinion? Because this is, you know, a lot of new issues.
Yes, I would. I mean, as opposing counsel kind of pointed at, there is very little case law on Merler. A lot of what we refer to throughout
our... if you win, that makes a PFR all the more likely.
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
I said, if you win and it's presidential, that makes the granting of a PFR all the more likely. You are aware of that?
Understood.
Okay. So you're that confident of victory?
I am.
Okay.
Well,
I'm not, but, you know, we have to decide the case, but that's a different issue.
Right. I do think Merler, although it is understandably somewhat arbitrary and ambiguous, and obviously there's not a whole lot of precedent for the court to go off of here, I do think it's plain language when applying to these facts specifically undoubtedly shows that we should win on appeal. As I kind of already touched on with the agricultural exemption, moving into the responsible person, you know, I would argue this issue has been waived. There was no real explicit waiver or raising of this issue of whether or not Mr. Green is a responsible person under Merler at the district court level. There was only a generalized argument about his personal liability, citing to his tortuous conduct and piercing the corporate veil, which, as the trial court found, is irrelevant for the purposes of a responsible person under Merler. Regardless, the facts are clearly show that he is a responsible person. A responsible person under Merler is defined in part as anyone who owns or operates a facility from which a hazardous substance is stored or released. And Mr. Green, as Ms. Pissarro pointed out, he owns the property the release came from. He owns the company that caused the release, and he owns the facility from which that company operates from. Additionally, he admitted to instructing the installation of the pipe that caused the contamination on Ms. Hogendorf's property. And moving on to removal costs, I do think the language of Merler is also pretty straightforward here. Merler defines a removal cost as any action that's necessary to monitor and evaluate a release or to mitigate its impact. And this is exactly what the trial court found here. The trial court specifically found, I believe as Ms. Judge Wheelock pointed at, was that Landmark's involvement in the investigation was reasonable and necessary to evaluate, mitigate, and respond to this release in order to come to an equitable result in this case. This included the fact that they conducted deep groundwater sampling on their own dime to identify the presence of agricultural chemicals at a deep groundwater level after both the MDA and Pinnacle refused to do so, which inevitably expanded the investigation and eventually the remediation as well. This also includes them evaluating the samples taken by Pinnacle at the deep groundwater level for DRO, diesel range organics. Pinnacle had asserted that this was from naturally occurring substances like pine needles without actually doing the chromatograph testing that's necessary to make that determination. Landmark, again, on their own dime, evaluated these samples and found that, no, it was from petroleum products. And additionally, Landmark was intimately involved in the placement of wells throughout the property, as well as analyzing the geology underneath Ms. Hogendorf's property, and specifically the semi-confining layer, in determining the migration of the groundwater contamination in order to protect Ms. Hogendorf's well from further contamination. And lastly, I would just point out that Landmark was also involved in identifying and evaluating a second area of contamination that occurred after the state agencies became involved in this case. So while appellants are arguing here that there should be some bright line cutoff for removal costs in this case at the time the state agencies became involved, this kind of ignores both what I would argue is the plain language of the statute and the facts. The plain language says all reasonable and necessary removal costs. Reasonable and necessary, I would argue, requires a fact-intensive analysis, not some bright-line rule. Additionally, the facts, as I kind of already noted, show that even after the state agencies became involved, the appellants continued to discharge pesticide rinsate and other hazardous chemicals onto Ms. Hogendorf's property, necessitating an ongoing response from Ms. Hogendorf's environmental consultant, Landmark. Lastly, I would just like to address the idea appellants postulate in their brief about the fact that there is no diminution in property value once it has been remediated. I would argue this both flies in the face of the law and the facts. The law, as I kind of already addressed in Dealers Manufacturing and Westling, show that there can be a stigma associated with the property after it has been properly remediated, or even if it isn't contaminated, if it's in proximity to a property that's contaminated, or even if there's just the threat of contamination. Here, as Judge Wheelock pointed out, there was 2 decades of discharges on Walgreen Lawn's property, and the trial court found that this likely resulted in similar releases as those that happened on Ms. Hogendorf's property and caused that contamination. While there wasn't a huge investigation in the Walgreen Lawn's property, this inevitably, for a hypothetical buyer, would present a risk to anybody who's going to purchase Ms. Hogendorf's property, worrying about the idea that there could be a migration of groundwater contamination from appellant's property to Ms. Hogendorf's. This also ignores the fact that on the date of trial, remediation was actually ongoing. It had not been completed. The MDA recognized on the date of trial, they testified that there would be residual contamination left on the property. As I pointed out, the 2 decades of discharges continue to pose a threat to Ms. Hogendorf. And as the trial court found, Walgreen Lawns is still operating next door without proper safeguards, despite the recommendation of the MDA, the MPCA, and their own environmental consultant, Pinnacle. So all of these facts taken together show that, you know, it doesn't make sense to not factor that in when considering whether or not there's a diminution value after remediation is completed.
Going back on this point, assume that we agree with both of you that we need to issue or we should issue a precedential opinion, and we're trying to express a distinction between an economic loss and an actual economic loss. So we're giving meaning to the word actual. How do we draw the line? What do you recommend we provide as a definition to each of those terms?
To each of those terms? In terms of economic loss, I think that is more, it's a more broad meaning. So I would think of it in the sense of, Ms. Pissarro pointed out that it could be rendered speculative. So if you're even looking at, a business that, I forget the case specifically, but where they're seeking future profits or anything of the sort, in that sense, I do think you're looking at more of an economic loss. Where I think the actual comes in is that you have to show that on the date of trial, especially when you're actually awarding this damage, there is a damage that's been incurred.
That's the difference between present and future loss as opposed to actual and non-actual. I'm trying to get a sense of how would we, if you've used the word arbitrary to define the statute, are you referring to this definition or some other part of it?
I'm sorry, could you reword that?
You referred to Murley. You said, it's an arbitrary.
Yeah.
It's ambiguous. Those are your words. Are you agreeing that the term actual economic loss is one of those ambiguities?
I would point, so if you point back to the trial court's ruling, one of the things they point out in there is the fact that there was redundancy within some of the language of MRLA, especially with regarding, I think it was normal application. They took the normal out of application because it meant the same. I would argue that the same is true here, that the actual, in terms of actual economic loss, could be removed and mean the same as economic loss. I think either way, actual economic loss and economic loss was meant to mean the same thing when the legislature drafted MRLA.
So you would have us say, I'm sorry, your time is up. Do you mind, may I ask one more?
Please.
So I gather you would have us say that the word actual is just superfluous, doesn't add anything, it means nothing.
Essentially, yes. I would argue that it
kind of flies in the face of the way we generally interpret statutes. We were asked to give meaning to every word.
I understand. I do think, you know, as it was pointed out by legal authorities like Professor Kloss and the trial court below, MRLA was hastily drafted. It was to kind of frame after the federal counterpart CERCLA, which is also the same way, where there can be both ambiguity, perhaps superfluous language, and I would argue it's kind of the same here.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, and your time is up.
Thank you.
We'll have 5 minutes added to the clock, and we'll turn back to counsel for appellant for the last word. And feel free to adjust the podium, and please introduce yourself at the beginning again.
Cara Passaro here on behalf of the appellants. May it please the court. So I'd like to turn to MRLA's definition of release, and in particular what release does not include. And that's contained in Minnesota Statute 115B.02 subdivision 15. And that indicates that a release does not include any release resulting from the application of fertilizer or agricultural or silvicultural chemicals or disposal of emptied pesticide containers or residues from a pesticide as defined in Section 18B.01, Subdivision 18. So we then must turn to that section to look at the definition of rinsate. Rinsate is defined by Minnesota law as a dilute mixture of a pesticide or pesticides with water, solvents, oils, commercial rinsing agents, or other substances that is produced by or results from the cleaning of pesticide application equipment or pesticide containers.
So the statute references subdivision 18, which is the definition of pesticide. It doesn't reference the definition of rinsate. It points us to subdivision 18, not subdivision 25. And isn't that important? Because isn't that an indication that they meant to exclude that subdivision 25?
Not necessarily. Again, like I said, rinsate is pesticide residue. So it would be redundant for them to call it out again in the definition of release.
Again, I think that we could only agree with you if we think that rinsate and residue are the same thing, in which case they should have used the same word, right?
But only if, not if they thought it was redundant and superfluous and unnecessary to call out rinsate, insofar as rinsate is created from residue. So inclusion of residue would, by extension, include the rinsate. Does that adequately address your concerns about the distinction between residue and rinsate?
Well, I understand what your position is.
Okay. So if I could, with the remainder of the time that I have, I'd like to address a little bit the responsible person arguments that are being made by respondent. I would note that it was raised in the closing argument that was presented to the trial court, the fact that there are facts that emerged during the course of the trial that Jim Green Jr. as the owner of the property where the Well-Groomed Lawns operation was housed, did in fact direct installation of the pipe. But we don't see anything in the record that is the intentional polluting type activity that you would need for him to be deemed a responsible person individually under the statute. The sort of willful and wanton type of activity, there's no indication that there was anything of that nature at all. And as a result, the appellants would ask that this court reverse the trial court in its finding that he was a responsible person under the statute. One other thing I would like to note with the last minute that I have is the issue again of removal costs and the distinction between removal costs and remedial costs. Removal costs were always intended under MRLA to be costs that were incurred to address an imminent, emergent threat. And again, the argument that's being advanced by the appellants here is that 6 months hence, 6 months removed from the notice of violation issued by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, there is no emergent, imminent threat anymore. And so as a result, in the event that there is a qualifying release found here such that the respondent is entitled to recover some removal costs, what we have advanced is that they be limited to those costs that were incurred in the lead up to that notice of violation issuance, that this court basically established some sort of a bright line as to when the costs are no longer removal costs and are instead remedial.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, thank you for your argument. Thank you to both counsel for your argument today, as well as for the briefing. It was very helpful, and we will take this under advisement. The case is submitted, and we will issue a decision within the time frame required. Thank you. Thank you.